Okay, well, let me tell you a little bit about control. So thank you very much for the invitation. It's been fun to be here. I want to tell you two simple stories. I was planning on telling you one big grand story, but I thought maybe at the end I'll tell you two simpler concrete stories. I'm going to tell you how we use quantum information processing ideas to improve very old problems in physics and allow us to make measurements today that we couldn't make a couple of years ago. One story is going to be on neutron interferometry, that work I do with a postdoc, Dmitry Pushkin, and my collaborator, Mohammad Arif. Another on using, creating a robust means of having Karpfer-Seller dynamical decoupling methods, work done with Troy Bornemann and Cecilia Lopez. Okay, neutron interferometry. Neutron interferometry is a path-dependent Mach-Zehnder interferometer, and it is the very best way of measuring cross-sections. It is a wonderful way of understanding proton structures and proteins. It is a wonderful way of understanding magnetic materials. By far, the most precise measurements for these, and it's never used. And the reason it's never used is it's incredibly difficult to have a robust interferometry setup. And so I want to tell you what's wrong with the old approaches and how we can change it, and with a little bit of quantum information science, come up with a new approach to neutron interferometry. And I'll even show you that it works. So with neutron interferometers, we've got a neutron. I can't see these things. We've got a neutron coming in from the right-hand side, a beam of neutrons. It comes into a perfect single crystal interferometer, splits into two beams, and then gets reflected at the central blade and recombined at the third blade to have interference. And so there's really two parameters that we care about to define the Hilbert space. There's the neutron spin, which will be important later on in the path degrees of freedom. So here we have our neutron interferometer. It is about 10 centimeters across. It's machined from one perfect single crystal of silicon. Okay, so the whole thing is one perfect single crystal of silicon. These blades are sticking up, and they're very precisely machined. We send in a beam of neutrons. They're, in our case, about 2.1 angstroms, so they're slowly moving neutrons, less than 2,000 meters per second. At the first blade, it undergoes Lowy scattering. So what's going to happen is the neutrons interact with the single crystal silicon, and they'll either be transmitted through or reflected, and, of course, reflected back into the interferometer. It's a really simple problem. We have the neutrons coming in. We have a diffraction event, two paths. Every time we have a blade, we have exactly the same process. So there's a diffraction event at the second blade. Now, of course, the neutrons that are transmitted through that second blade leave the experiment. And we just assume that those neutrons don't carry any unique information. And so when we scale the problem, we'll forget that we have those neutrons leaving the interferometer. Two passive neutrons recombine at the third blade. And, of course, we want to have a phase here. So when they recombine, they're going to interfere. We'll see that. And we introduce a phase shift. We introduce a phase shift by putting a little piece of silicon inside one of those beams. And so there's a refractive index for the silicon. The neutrons slow down just a little bit. We introduce a phase. The phase, of course, is only on the upper path of the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. We have the two paths recombine. And, of course, we can define a wave function for the upper and lower paths. The upper path, the so-called open beam, is very nice because T and R are the transmission reflection coefficients, and you can see that the coefficients in front of the upper and lower are exactly the same. The lower path, the so-called H path, the transmission reflection coefficients come in slightly differently. Small issue, the upper path is the nicest one. And so if we look at interference, just measuring the intensity. Of course, we're going to measure with a helium-3 detector. We don't miss any neutrons. Every neutron that hits our helium-3 detector, we see. And we can see that nicely we have counts per unit time versus the phase we introduce from the phase flag, and we get a nice contrast. That's an old result. This is about as good as it gets in neutron interferometry. So we've got a contrast. Now, of course, if it was perfect contrast, this would come down to zero. We have a contrast about 84%. So all of that is good, and you think that we could use it. The challenge with neutron interferometry is to look at the vertical axis, and you see that we have about 1,000 counts a minute. Now, in the neutron beam that's coming, that we're stealing these neutrons from, that neutron, that waveguide, has 10 to the 14 neutrons per centimeter squared per second. So we've got 10 to the 14 per centimeter squared per second in the beam. At our detector, we've got 1,000. I tell you, we don't miss any in the detector. So somewhere, we're losing a neutron or two. And what's happening is that the neutron interferometer is so sensitive to temperature variations in vibrations that we've had to build an elaborate experimental facility to isolate it from the environment. So we have the beam break over here, and then about 15 meters away, we have this room that's set on a vibration stand with a temperature control, then set on another vibration with another temperature control, and set on another vibration with another temperature control. And the whole thing becomes so cumbersome that the solid angle that we're subtending of the original neutron beam path in the waveguide is essentially zero. And so we see no neutrons. Now, the problem with neutron interferometry is really easily summed up in a classic, a simple model. If the neutron is transmitted and the crystal is vibrating, well, the neutron doesn't care. If it's transmitted, it doesn't see that change in motion of the crystal. But if it's reflected, it does pick up a change in momentum. And you can see that the two beams coming together, one had to be reflected up and one had to be reflected down. And so the beams get spread out relative to each other. They come together either before or after the phase of this crystal. And so we by having a vibration, we've moved the interference effect away from the coherence length of the neutrons. And so we lose all of our contrast. And it's easy to calculate. And so here we've calculated the contrast that we expect versus the frequency of vibration. This is for a linear vibration. And you can see that it falls off pretty quickly if you had vibrations of a few tens of hertz. If I look at the rotational degrees of freedom of the interferometer, of course, it's much more sensitive to that because we're coming in and diffracting off those blades. The orientation matches. And you can see that even if I have 5 hertz of vibration, I've lost all my contrast. The reason we have these recurrences is that I'm looking at a sinusoidal vibration, right? I'm looking at the frequency components of that. But the important part is, hey, this thing falls off quickly. So I thought about this and suggested that we could avoid these vibrations because the interferometer is vibrating as a solid body. We have one crystal that is our neutron interferometer, and it moves together. The internal vibrations of the interferometer are at very, very high frequencies. We don't need to worry about those. And so I can think about the errors as being correlated along the path of the interferometer. And so if we're thinking about dynamical decoupling, we would say, what I should do is I should bounce the neutron once up and then I should bounce it down. And so you can see in this neutron interferometer where all I've done is to add one more beam, one more blade, we have two paths. It's still a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, but I've taken the Mach-Zehnder interferometer and I've twisted it to introduce a 180-degree pi pulse, if you like. And, of course, the paths cross here, but there's no interference. There's no blade, no interference. And under this arrangement, every neutron is hit, gets one change in momentum one direction, one change in momentum in the other direction. And by doing that, we have we correct for this change in phase. Now, actually, I didn't develop this thinking about dynamical decoupling. I developed it thinking about decoherence-free subspaces. And I'm not going to explain that, but clearly there's another path here that I could have drawn. I could have put another blade here. And that would show that this is a decoherence-free subspace. But let's just continue. So here's the calculation. That's the 3-blade, and that's the 4-blade up there. And you see that the 4-blade, as we expect, extends out longer. Now, of course, eventually it's got to fall off, because if you have fast enough vibrations, eventually they become uncorrelated. What's the correlation time? The time it takes a neutron to get through the interferometer. Okay, so we did the experiment. This is the interferometer that we built. And we built the interferometer in such a way that we could have the 4-blade version, so the neutrons coming in, scattered, then scattered this way, then scattered back. Okay, so we've got the 4-blade, or we have a 3-blade path. The neutrons come in, get transmitted, diffracted, transmitted, diffracted. Okay, and I can choose which one of those I want just by placing some cadmium, which is a very good neutron absorber in different places. And if I look at the 3-blade case, I see that, yes, when I introduce vibrations or allow my friends in the rest of the guide hall to introduce vibrations, we lose the contrast. And with the 4-blade, it is beautifully clean. So now this says, great, what I can do is I could take that neutron interferometer, take it out of all those rooms, put it right next to the guide break, and have a much larger solid angle, a much more sensitive arrangement. And if we look at the contrast versus frequency, we see that it falls off correctly. That for the 3-blade, it falls off at about 7 hertz. And I have to rescale this, but that is actually correct. Now, one of the things that really annoyed me when we built this thing is that I only had contrast in the good days of 24%. And I showed you that we had a crystal that had contrast of 85%. And you know what happens is if I have a blade of silicon that a pi phase shift is about 40 microns of silicon. Okay, so I've got a displaced beam, and I don't want to have a phase shift over that displaced beam. So I can't have any surface imperfections that are on the scale of a few tens of microns or maybe even 10 microns. I want these blades to be of uniform thickness to within some few microns. And that's very hard to do. Now, when we built this, we were assured that it would be easy to do. When it didn't work, I went back to my colleagues and said, what gives? And they said, well, in fact, only 1 in 50 crystals ever does work. It takes us a year to get this thing built, and I think, hey man, we got to have 1 in 50 to get a good contrast. I'm going to retire before then, I hope. So what's going on, of course, is not only do they have surface defects, but when they're machining it, they introduce heating in this, and they get small crystal changes in the blades. So I want to take another idea from quantum information processing. In addition to coherent to error correction, we're going to apply the power of 1 qubit. I'm going to apply the DQC1 model to this to take an interferometer which has no inherent contrast and to reintroduce contrast to it through the addition of another qubit, another degree of freedom. The other degree of freedom, of course, is the spin in our case. So remember the DQC1 model. The DQC1 model says I have a set of qubits. One of them I can prepare in a polarized state. The rest of them are fully mixed. I'm going to do an interferometry experiment. That's what this is. This is an interferometer. It says apply Hadamard gate and then a conditional gate on the fully mixed spins. Do that and then make a measurement. And what I measure is the trace of this control operation. So, what I want to do is to use the spin as the pure qubit, because I can prepare polarized spins very easily. I'm going to use the path as the qubit that's fully mixed. Now, what the algorithm says is I could apply a controlled gate, a controlled path based upon spin. Right, that's what the DQC1 algorithm says. A drive is a controlled knot, but it's any controlled unitary. Now, I can't do that. We don't have any gates at our disposal that are a controlled path based upon spin. But it's an easy thing to do to show that if I sandwich a controlled knot or any controlled U by Hadamard's, I can change the order of that. And so now I say, okay, fine. What we're going to do is instead of applying this controlled knot, we'll apply this one. Now then, I've got this particular gate. Of course, the Hadamard's deconstruct. So a Hadamard's is its own inverse. I can remove those two. We're left with this gate, and this looks very much like our neutron interferometer. The Hadamard is this blade, right? The Hadamard says, create a superposition between paths. That's that blade. The Hadamard at the end says, okay, take and create a superposition between blades, all right? So those are the two Hadamards on the path degree of freedom. The conditional gate, well, that's easy. It says do something in one part of the interferometer, one arm of the interferometer, and don't do something in the other. We can easily do that. This distance is 20 centimeters. I include a phase flag for the fun of it. At the end of it, I want to measure the spin degree of freedom, right? So the spin degree of freedom is going to carry the information. And we do that by having spin polarized helium-3. So helium-3 is easy to spin polarize. Now there's one further trick that says, hey, I've got to take this whole thing and flip it around, but it doesn't matter whether I run a gate forward or backwards. I'm running a sequence forwards or backwards. So we end up running it backwards, and this we're trying to show. But now, with this idea and the error correction, we'll be able to use all these crystals that people have locked away in their cabinets that never had good contrast. We'll be able to do the measurements of neutron interferometry, and we'll get about 60 times the intensity. Okay, let me now change subjects. I'll tell you about Carpuccell sequences. So a very simple model of a noise that we have in all sorts of qubits. I'm going to take an inhomogeneous field of magnetic resonance. So think about this as a field that varies over space. And of course, if I allow the spins to evolve in that, they get wound up in a helix. So I'm plotting here is mx and my versus the spatial coordinate z. And if I just allow the spins to evolve in a linear gradient, of course, they get wound up into a helix. And we've already heard that, of course, if you apply a pi pulse, the pi pulse is going to flip the helix from a right-handed helix to a left-handed helix. And once I have this left-handed helix, if I allowed it to evolve, all the spins would come back together. And incoherence is very, very easy to remove that way. But the original reasons, and that's what Hahn did. That was in '48, Hahn's development. What Carpuccell said was there's more things going on. What goes on in addition to having this helix, as I told you, the phase is dependent upon location. But in liquid states NMR, of course, the molecules are moving. And so they scramble that phase. You lose that coherence. And so the grating becomes attenuated. And that is an irreversible process because, of course, molecular diffusion is random. And so what Carr and Purcell said in 54 was don't apply one pulse. That takes care of the static inhomogeneities, but apply a series of pulses and spaced by some time tau with a diffusion coefficient and a gradient here, and that's just the gyromagnetic ratio constant, you get a rate of decay that goes as tau squared. And so as you make tau smaller and smaller and smaller, you can suppress the effect of molecular diffusion as much as you like. And you can completely remove that if you're able to pulse fast enough. The challenge is that we would like to have a really long relaxation time, so we want to have lots and lots and lots of pulses. But every pulse has an error. And so we don't want the error from these individual pulses to accumulate. I'm going to skip all that. It's fascinating stuff. But I'm going to run out of time. So how do we keep the full state in this? And there's three ways you can do it. The first way is to say, hey, let's limit the number of pulses. But, you know, that's not very interesting. The second way says, hey, we're introducing these errors ourselves. let's just make sequences that are more and more and more forgiving of those errors. And John Waugh in the late 60s and early 70s gave us a recipe for that. We know how to do that. And Terry Gillian applied that to this particular problem. I'm going to show you his solution. What I want to do today is to use quantum information processing. Not only do we know those errors, but those errors are going to affect every spin the same way. And so those errors actually is a very nice noise. It's something that we know how to code for. And so I want to code for it and simply get rid of them altogether. Okay? So what I've shown here, and let me show this first. What I've shown down here, let's get this first, is the Karpov cell sequence described as a polychannel. Okay, so I've looked at the dynamics of the Karpov cell sequence with real pulses, all the garbage fit in here, okay, and I've described it as its Krauss operator representation as a polychannel. Here's the identity operator. This is sigma y, and sigma x and sigma z are right down here. Now what you see about this, remember these are the operations. What you see about this is under the Karpov cell sequence, you can keep sigma y around for a long time. In fact, we can keep sigma y around for tens of thousands of pulses. But sigma x and sigma z, you're going to lose quickly because this looks like a dephasing channel about the y-axis. We then take and modify the Karpov cell sequence slightly to this particular range of pulses up there from via Terry Gillian, so x, y, x, y, y, x, etc. And now I still have a dephasing channel. Okay, it's dephasing about z now, just because of the symmetries that we've imposed with those pulses, but it's a much, much weaker dephasing channel. And you can see that we're going out to 1,000 cycles, which is 16,000 pulses, and we have only weak dephasing about z. And so Terry's made a great contribution, right? I mean, this thing is only over here. And that's fun, but we can do better. So let's do better. Besides, that's 1995. So what we're going to do is say, okay, we'll use the Karpov cell sequence to get rid of the inhomogeneities. We'll use it to suppress molecular diffusion. And doing so, we're going to introduce these correlated errors. The correlated errors we're going to get rid of by DFS coding. You remember what a DFS coding says? It says, hey, let me code into a space of two spins, in this case, that are anti-aligned, directed along the error field, so that they are a constant of motion of that error. We could describe that in more detail, but we won't bother. This is old work showing that, if you encode things correctly, it works. It works experimentally. Okay. Remember that the Karpov cell sequence, the errors are along y. So this is the logical encoding for the DFS as we normally use it with the quantization along z. We simply rotate the thing. So now we have the quantization along y. And we have the logical operators that we would expect. These logical operators are exactly the same ones you would use for the XY16 sequence, Terry sequence. We're going to use them for the Karpov cell. There's a small issue. If I add another qubit, of course, I have to include the coupling between the two qubits. I've added another term of the Hamiltonian. So there's a sigma dot sigma coupling between those qubits. You need to respect that. We've got to pay attention to all the details. And this says, hey, if we respect that, there's a nice part of the Hamiltonian. The sigma dot sigma part of the Hamiltonian with the error terms has a direct sum representation over SU4. And so the part that we're coding, the zero quantum part, okay, is separable from the rest of it. We'll use that. So here's the sequence. We apply a Karpov cell sequence, and then in between the Karpov cell sequence, I'm going to apply a sigma x operator. What that sigma x pulse does is it takes away the scalar coupling contributions to this problem. Okay, but the scalar coupling contributions, that's a unitary evolution. So it doesn't matter how often I do that, because that is refocusing a time-independent term in the Hamiltonian. Okay, So I run the Karpov cell sequence for as long as I want, hit it once with this pi x pulse in the zero quantum space, apply the rest of the Karpov cell sequence, give another pi pulse, again about x, in the zero quantum space, just so that we return the state to the reference frame that we want it in. And now I look at the Pauli channel for this effect. And you can see that the Pauli channel is beautifully clean, that z, y, and x are zero, and they're zero for as long as you want to look. And the identity term has a very fast oscillation at the top and is a very slight attenuation over the system. Okay, very slight depolarizing effect, but then it's flat over the rest of the term. We can, with some trouble, even remove that piece. But this is the piece that says, yes, now we can store a qubit. We can store a qubit experimentally for a time of T1. Okay? And I'm going to skip all those things. Now, there's one more problem. There's no problem with this. You do this, it works. There's one more challenge that says, can you recognize experimentally that your noise is of a form that would allow you to apply these tricks? And we thought about that with Cecilia Lopez. And I'm going to try to tell you this in 2 seconds. Cecilia and the others in the group have been trying to characterize noise efficiently. And the piece of the noise we want to characterize efficiently is the noise random or is it gate dependent? If it's gate dependent, we're going to apply these tricks. I want to know that. And so in order to do this, we compare two sequences of twirling the system. And so remember what happens with a twirl. With a twirl, we apply a series of unitaries. We average over our choices of those unitaries. And on average, the dynamic should be a depolarizing channel. So we should see a nice fidelity decay. There's two approaches. I can choose a unitary. I'm choosing from the Clifford group. Could be random. Choose, undo. No errors, we get back to where we wanted. Loschmidt echo type thing. Or a random twirl. Choose, undo. And in the case of Markov errors, these two give you exactly the same thing. Okay? In the case that we have gate-dependent errors, we get different stories. And so here, I show you the solid lines are analytic, the dots are simulations in this case. The top is for this Loschmidt echo. We go forward, we come back with gate-dependent errors. We always get the single-strength parameter. That single-strength parameter tells us how big the errors are. Nothing else. Here, in the bottom, we have this this random twirl, forward, back, forward, back, forward, back. We can see that the initial slope is now not to first order, it's to second order, t squared type. So it looks Gaussian to begin with. You can have some revivals, you can have some oscillations, but already an initial slope, seeing that it's Gaussian, gives you a signature that uniquely tells you you have gate-dependent errors. Okay? And so we can use this to tell us that we should be applying these other techniques. Hey, okay, there was one slide that I've skipped over here, unfortunately. All right, so the conclusion is it's great to be thinking about building quantum computers. We would like to build quantum computers along with everyone else, but there's useful things that quantum information processing can uniquely tell us today. And it can attack problems that people have been thinking about for a long, long time with a new perspective. And that new perspective can be very powerful. These issues with the neutron interferometer, when we come and we show our colleagues at NIST these new solutions, they immediately pick up on it. It's clear that these ideas will work. But of course, although they've been working in the field for decades, they didn't think about it. And what quantum information processing gives us is a set of tools to direct us towards new solutions. The same thing with the decoupling. You know, decoupling has been an issue in NMR since the late 40s. And we haven't in the past really wanted to keep a full state. Now when we want to keep a full state, we want to keep it robustly for a long time. It forces us to look for new solutions, and quantum information processing gives us those. So, you know, I'm sure there's lots of other examples. It's a fun time. So thank you, and I'll answer any questions.